Greetings, everyone. Even though I had spoken before our group in London and talked to you about a sermon I intended giving there for the tape program, the situation in the Middle East was so fluid and there was so little understanding of what Saddam Hussein might do on a day-to-day basis that I went on to Berlin as I had been scheduled, arriving there just at about the time that the de Lazieri government had fallen and some of them had walked out of parliament, and also at the celebration of the 101st birthday of Adolf Hitler by about 30,000 skinheads who were making a human swastika out in front of the parliament buildings and shouting anti-Semitic and anti-foreign worker slogans and beating up on people from Bangladesh, and also one elderly Jewish man that they hospitalized. They say there are about 30,000 of them over there. They were wearing swastika armbands and saying Heil Hitler and giving the Nazi salute, which was a little bit frightening in one sense of the word, although they are a fringe and an extreme group. At any rate, I then came back to the United States, and I've been keeping an hourly watch in my own television set on CNN in my office about what's happening in the Middle East. So instead of the sermon tape that I did in London, I have now come to our radio studios here in the office in Tyler. And I want to give you on this tape, from the perspective of this moment, the overview of what is happening in the Middle East, what it says in Bible prophecy from the standpoint of the King of the North and the King of the South in the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, and also a kind of a where do we go from here in biblical prophecy. Is Saddam Hussein the King of the South? Is this some kind of a war that is going to lead toward the Battle of Armageddon and the Great Tribulation and the time of the end? Jesus Christ of Nazareth was asked, you read of that in Matthew 24, tell us, what shall be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world? And Jesus answered and said, this is verse 4 of Matthew 24, take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, not that they are the Christ, but that he, Christ, is Christ, and shall deceive many. And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. Now next he said to his people, see that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. So Christ said we would be living in a time of wars and rumors of wars, and certainly massive deployment of U.S. military forces in Saudi Arabia, wildly gyrating stock markets, skyrocketing prices of oil, skyrocketing prices also of insurance rates for shipping in the Gulf, and the resultant crunch that is going to hit people all over the world in any of the developed countries, especially the heavily industrialized countries of the West, United States, Western Europe, Japan, and so on, involving trucking, involving heating oil during the coming winter, and an economic blow that is going to affect us in every conceivable part of our economy just straight across the board. All has come about as a result of Saddam Hussein's immediate, unexpected, pre-dawn blitzkrieg of tiny, virtually defenseless Kuwait. Now a massive buildup of U.S. military forces together with certain increments, rather token forces, from many other nations, including Saudi Arabia, Syria, and even little Bangladesh, has actually the entire world reeling with economic shock. Stock markets from Frankfurt to New York and from London to Tokyo have been gyrating wildly and then plunged sharply down. Interest rates rose, gold soared, oil prices, as you know, are up everywhere, and of course at the pump as well. So it's about time we took a look at what the Bible says in the overview about wars and rumors of wars. First, let's remember the Bible is a Middle Eastern book. It views the world from the historical, geographical, and the political, and the prophetic perspective, looking out from the Middle East, especially from Jerusalem, in Palestine. About one-third of the Bible is prophecy. And prophecy is the outline of the plan and the purpose of God being worked out here below, the overall general global trends and conditions. There are many areas of the Bible that lack specificity. Jesus Christ, for example, did not, as shocking as it may sound, prophesy the Second World War. There is not one single scripture standing out all by itself to which you can point other than the Olivet Prophecy that talks about wars and rumors of wars and nation against nation and kingdom against kingdom, where you can see laid out before you all of the events that took place over that incredibly costly world war that took some 70 million lives eventually, perhaps 30 million of them in Russia alone. So when you realize that and you take a look at Bible prophecy and you ask, well, what about this latest round of war, this brinksmanship, this constant tension, this fear and worry of the possibility of chemical weapons being used against U.S. forces or the hostage taking by Saddam Hussein's army and so on? Is that prophesied? Can we see that somewhere in the Bible? We will see as we go along whether or not that is so and whether or not this is something that is rather a forerunner, like a harbinger of something that is yet to occur, or whether it's something that is specifically prophesied. Now remember that Christ was the most important of all the prophets. He gave a step-by-step format for the final fulfillment of all Bible prophecy. It is famous Olivet prophecy, and we find those in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. They're all parallel accounts by different reporters, which is what the disciples really were, that reported, took down, wrote the words that Christ gave. Matthew 24 is the most complete of all of them. And that is the vital key that unlocks the mysterious prophecies of Daniel in the book of Revelation, and which guarantees God's true church, of which he is the living head, of which Christ is the head, that they would know the true picture of frightening world events and would know how to watch. Now, when Christ said, "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars," he also added, "See that you be not troubled." And what does that mean? Well, if you're troubled, you are fearful, you're nervous, you are apprehensive, you are in doubt. It is certainly the opposite of faith. A troubled person is not necessarily a faithful person. So he said, "Be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." Now, when he said not to be troubled, that means if you go on to look at what the Apostle Paul said when he warned the people in the church in Thessalonica that they were not to be soon shaken in mind, and that is reading in 2 Thessalonians, I should say, chapter 2, verses 2 to 4, where he is talking about letting no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, a son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, or that is worship, so that he, as God, sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Now, in both cases, Christ said, not to be troubled. And Paul said, be not soon shaken in mind. And then Christ said, let no man deceive you. And Paul said, let no man deceive you by any means. And then Christ said, the end is not yet. And Paul said, that day shall not come except there come a falling away first. That's one massive thing involving religion, a general falling away from the truth, an abandonment of the truth of God, people recanting, going back into the great false religion that is depicted in the 17th chapter as the great harlot and the false prophet being at the head of that church that is identified in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation as sitting in an ancient city called the Eternal City, dominated by seven hills, and there is only one city in the entirety of the world that really fits that description, and that city is Rome. So notice the parallels of those two very important prophecies. Then Paul went on to say that there would be a man of sin who would be revealed, called the son of perdition. Obviously, the same individual as the great false prophet of Revelation, the 13th chapter, the image of the beast, and the great false prophet that is in collusion with the beast, or the great military dictator of Revelation 17, who is over all 10 of those nations who give their power and their strength into an organization called the Beast. Now, this individual opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he, as God, calling himself God, calling down fire from heaven, perhaps surrounded with the proverbial bleeding or crying statues and having the evil satanic power to appear to work all sorts of marvels and mysterious signs and symbols so that people are mesmerized and hoodwinked who want to believe in miracles. And he, as God, sits in the temple of God, showing that he is God. Now, there is no way that the expression temple of God means the church. Here's why. Some people have had the idea that if you give by analogy the fact that the church is God's house or the church is his temple or that we are the temple of God and so on, that perhaps this could mean some false minister or some leader of some latter-day branch of God's church some people still believe in things like eras and so on, would rise up and that he would be this man of sin, and that this is talking about the temple of God, meaning the church. No way. And here's why. When the Apostle Paul wrote these words to the church in Thessalonica, the temple in Jerusalem still stood. So in Paul's mind, there was a gigantic building down there, the very same building that had been pointed out by the disciples to Christ, and in which Christ had taught, where he overthrew the money changers' tables, where he witnessed the little lady who was throwing her last little tiny bit of offering into the treasury, where he stooped on the floor and wrote the names of people when the Jews were accusing him and brought the woman caught in adultery, where he performed miracles and healed people and taught from the time he was a boy of 12 years of age. That is the very building the Apostle Paul had in mind when he said this false prophet, as God, will sit in the temple of God. Now notice the parallel in Christ's prophecy in Matthew 24. After talking about the beginning of the Great Tribulation and the great martyrdom of saints, he said the gospel would be preached in all the world as a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Then he got very specific in Matthew 24 and verse 15. He said, when you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, parenthetically said, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Neither let him that is in the field return to take back his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to those that give suck, or nursing mothers, in those days. And urge them, pray that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not from the beginning of the world at this time. No, nor ever indeed shall be. And he went on to say, except those days should be shortened, there would not be a man, woman, or child left alive on this earth. There should no flesh be saved. And as Moffat's version adds it, be saved alive. It's not talking about spiritual salvation, but about physical survival. Except those days should be shortened, meaning divine intervention, cutting short global nuclear war. There would no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. So, here you have the picture of those events that are going to portray, they're going to lead directly into the beginning of the Great Tribulation. And what is one of the most important events spoken of both by Jesus Christ and the Apostle Paul? The Apostle Paul talks about a man of sin being revealed, standing in the very temple of God, claiming he is God. And Christ says, when you shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. Now, Christ spoke that right in the environs of the temple itself. And right there inside that innermost part of the temple was the Holy of Holies, or the holy place. And that is exactly what Christ meant. Now, in the lifetime of many of those people that heard some of those words, Titus' armies in 71 A.D. came in and destroyed Jerusalem. They prized some of the stones loose from the top of the wall. They destroyed the temple buildings. But prior to that time, the Romans moved their standards before which they actually sacrificed and which they worshipped and which were pagan symbols into the temple and its environs. And, of course, we know then that swine's blood was actually sacrificed and sprinkled all over the Holy of Holies. And it was an abominable, desolate destruction and desecration of what was the holiest site to all of the Jews of Judaism at that time. So notice that once again, in the end time, we are to see some kind of a pollution called an abomination of desolation, apparently the intrusion of this great false prophet at the head of the Babylonian mystery religions, claiming that he is God, moving inside a temple of God. Now, there is no temple there. I know this man Kahane, who is an ultra-right-winger, and apparently there are a lot of other ultra-right-wing Orthodox Jewish leaders over there who have actually been building, putting together, I suppose, according to the old Levitical directions that they've gotten out of the book of Leviticus, they've actually been putting together some of the brazen vessels and the pots and the shields and this and that that have to do with temple worship under the Levitical priesthood, and they are stashed away in a building or building somewhere in Jerusalem. Now, over the years, there have been people that have said, well, the temple is about to be built. And there have even been rumors that there were stones waiting on docks in the eastern part of the United States, already pre-numbered and pre-quarried and everything, and the temple was virtually built. All he had to do was slap it together. Well, that's absolutely false. It's not true. There was never a bit of truth in it, even back over 20 years ago when those rumors first started around. There is no temple built yet. In order to satisfy this prophecy, then, there has to be either a temple built, a completed temple, and sacrifices begun, or perhaps a temporary temple of either canvas or wood, with perhaps the dedication of some cornerstone. Maybe they will discover some ancient cornerstone of the temple. And maybe, as I've speculated over the years, they will actually discover at some time through archaeology, deep in some subterranean tunnel beneath Jerusalem, the Ark of the Covenant. Now, here's why I speculate about that. Because today, Israel is an irreligious country. The religious people who are ultra-Orthodox and those who believe that they are really practicing the religion of Moses, which they are not, but a lot of do's and don'ts and added on things according to Talmudic tradition, are very much in the minority. They are in the minority in the Knesset, in the Israeli government, and they're basically in ill repute among a largely irreligious majority. So you have to ask the question, how could a temple be financed? How could it be built? How could it become a part of the very religious and social life of a nation that today is so irreligious that Shabbat, or the Sabbath, is a holiday and where hundreds of thousands of people take to the beaches or go out or play around and do all kinds of things? Well, obviously, one of several things, as I said. Perhaps the discovery of the Ark of the Covenant. But what if something like that took place together with a massive military setback, perhaps weapons like chemical weapons being used against Tel Aviv, the loss of tens of thousands of Israeli lives, even up into the hundreds of thousands, the specter of a new Holocaust, the loss of the territories gained in the 67 war? When you stop to think about it, there has to be some catalyst of some kind which results in some wave of religious fervor which grips the hearts of millions of Israelis to bring about the building of a temple, the establishment and the appointing of a priesthood, and the commencement of sacrifices. And that has got to come to pass before you're going to be able to see this false prophet stand in the holy place where he ought not, or the abomination of desolation. So think about those things from the overview and realize those things have not happened as yet. Now, even though Christ said that we're not to be soon troubled in mind, as though the day of Christ is at hand, and so on, not to be troubled, yet God's servants are supposed to be alert, His church is to be watchful, His people are to possess understanding of the dangerous times in which we live. Paul wrote this to the church in Thessalonica in 1 Thessalonians 5, verses 1 through 6. He said, "But of the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write unto you, for yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night. For when they shall say, peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, that day should overtake you as a thief. You are the children of light, and the children of the day. You're not of the night, nor of the darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep, spiritually, of course, as do others, but let us watch and be sober." Now, how ironic it would be if, while the whole world, from Japan to Germany, all over Europe, in Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, all over the entire known world, from Australia to Canada, should be disturbed, frightened, troubled over wars and rumors of wars, and God's own people should be asleep to the danger, that some leader in God's church would be saying to his people, "Now, there's no reason to get excited. This is not a significant event in prophecy. The wall coming down and German reunification and the creation of a united Germany, why, that's not important. There's no reason to get urgent now or to think that we're getting near anything." Wouldn't it be ironic if, while the whole world is disturbed, frightened, apprehensive, and troubled over wars and rumors of wars, God's own people would be asleep to the danger? And asleep to their demanding jobs and their responsibilities to be a witness and a warning, not only to God's people, but to the entirety of the world. Because true to Christ's prophecy, we are living in a time of wars and rumors of wars. Now look what has happened in just a short period of time. When Saddam Hussein sent those vastly superior mechanized divisions storming across the border with tiny Kuwait with his tank cannon blazing, it was over in a matter of hours. And then, of course, the looting and the raping began. Terrified refugees were telling of all kinds of atrocities by Iraqi troops, and some of them mere boys of 15 and 16. And in one case, a husband was at the point of a bayonet, forced to watch while they raped his wife. How Iraqi forces had plundered Kuwaiti businesses and banks. And by the way, it's rumored that Saddam Hussein looted perhaps several hundred million in gold and silver bullion and foreign currency from Kuwaiti banks. Now, though it was over very, very quickly so far as his occupation of tiny, virtually defenseless Kuwait, the savage attack against that little country sent shocks throughout the world. Stock markets reeled, as I said. Speculators wondered what this was going to mean to the world's most important energy source, which is oil. And very quickly, the United Nations responded, condemning Hussein's brutal advance, issued at least three or four by now separate resolutions demanding his unconditional withdrawal and reinstatement of the legitimate Kuwaiti government of the al-Sabah family. Saddam responded by announcing the annexation of Kuwait and openly loaded chemical warheads into military vehicles. So then the United States sought a united front of resistance to Hussein, and Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney flew all over the place, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and elsewhere, seeking permission for U.S. and pan-Arab forces to deploy because the United States wanted to look like a United Nations and a pan-Arab and a many nation multilateral force, not just unilateral action on the part of the United States. Look what happened within a very few days. Much of this while I was in England and Germany, and even as I was winging across the Atlantic returning back here to Tyler. First of all, the United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 660, 661, and 662, demanding immediate and unconditional withdrawal of Kuwaiti troops, imposing mandatory and comprehensive restrictions on trade with Iraq, and invalidating the annexation of Kuwait. Second, the Arab League voted, that is, 12 out of 21 of them did, to support sending an Arab force to Saudi Arabia to shore up other UN forces against possible further Iraqi aggression. Iraq, Libya, and the PLO, as you might guess, voted against it, and of course Yemen and Algeria abstained. Third, the EEC agreed to freeze Iraqi assets and to halt all trade with Iraq. That's all of the Economic Community of Europe. Then the WEU, that's the Western European Union, a separate organization, by the way, of the nine European nations that includes England, but outside of the context of NATO, as a defensive organization called the WEU, or the Western European Union, was talking about steps towards sending a naval task force to the Gulf. The Gulf region. OPEC called and is calling for, as I'm right here doing this program, emergency meetings to set higher production ceilings and to try to control the wildly gyrating oil prices. Various members have been balking, and OPEC shows signs of crumbling and becoming redundant. NATO reasserted its resolve to go to war against Iraq if Iraq should attack one of its member nations, which is Turkey. Australia sent two guided missile frigates and a supply ship to the Gulf and pledged to assist in halting ships engaged in trade with Iraq. Bangladesh sent 1,200 soldiers into Saudi Arabia. Belgium sent two minesweeping ships and one supply ship to the eastern Mediterranean, apparently to go on to the Gulf. Britain sent two squadrons of fighter bombers, offered use of British naval bases and other bases to U.S. forces, reinforced its naval units in the Gulf, and pledged to interdict Iraqi shipping. Canada sent two destroyers and a supply ship. Denmark said its merchant vessels would act as resupply ships for Western forces in the Gulf. Egypt sent 6,000 troops to Saudi Arabia, as did Syria. France sent an aircraft carrier, the Clemenceau, through the Suez Canal to the Gulf region, and she was carrying anti-tank combat helicopters. And also France sent a guided missile cruiser and two fleet tankers, a force totaling about 3,500 men. Greece said it would permit U.S. warplanes to overfly its territory. Italy sent two warships to the region as a part of the possible WEU force and said the U.S. could use NATO bases on its soil. Japan pledged sanctions, but said it was considering military response without precedent, whatever that meant, including sending communications and other personnel to Saudi Arabia. Jordan, of course, was caught in the middle, and Hussein was shuttling back and forth frantically here and there from Amman to Yemen and from Iraq to Washington, seeking some diplomatic solution in which he failed, and they closed the border, then reopened at the moment. Why, up to 20,000 refugees a day are flooding into tiny Jordan that cannot really take care of them, as people are fleeing in wild terror from what they suspect is going to break out into a full-fledged Middle Eastern war. Mexico said it would step up its oil production. Morocco sent 1,200 troops to Saudi Arabia as a token show of pan-Arab force. The Netherlands sent two frigates to the Gulf. Nigeria promised to increase oil production by 200,000 barrels per day. Pakistan sent 5,000 troops to Saudi Arabia. Portugal said the United States could use bases. And, of course, Saudi Arabia called for complete mobilization of all forces, closed Iraqi pipelines carrying oil, requested assistance from the U.S., Britain, and other Arab states. And here is something. The Soviet Union, in a move absolutely unprecedented since World War II, and I want to remind a lot of you listening that way back in the 1950s and all through the 1960s and even in the depths of the Cuban Missile Crisis, I was saying to audiences all over the United States and around the world and to tens of thousands of people in live audiences that Russia and the United States were not going to go to war, that the Iron Curtain would finally crumble, that Eastern European nations would come out from behind Soviet domination, and I said clearly, and there are plenty of documented evidences and plenty of sermon and broadcast tapes to prove it, way back decades ago, I said, you will finally see a time when the Soviet Union and the United States might well be allied together again, just like they were during World War II, against a common enemy. Now here we are with the Soviet Union, in moves unprecedented since World War II, pledging cooperation with the United States and the UN, saying they will halt all arms shipments to Iraq, saying they will help with its fleet units already in the Gulf to participate in interdiction of Iraqi shipping, and in every way being most helpful and cooperating like a virtual ally of the United States. Well, Switzerland accepted UN economic sanctions and froze Iraqi assets, which are considerable. No doubt hundreds of millions, if not a few billion, who knows, in Swiss banks. Syria sent a couple of thousand troops to Saudi Arabia. Turkey shut down both pipelines from Iraq through Turkish territory and, of course, agreed to the use of Turkish bases by U.S. forces and accepted deployment of U.S. F-111 fighter bombers. And the Turkish parliament, by the way, voted to accept all NATO forces on its soil and authorized the government to declare war if they were attacked by Iraq. Of course, the United States has sent the largest force overseas since the Vietnam War, estimated it up to 150,000 men and women in combined naval, air, and ground forces, and President Bush has now, as you know, called up portions, at least, of the reserves. Naval forces will ultimately include at least four aircraft carrier battle groups, one battleship, the Wisconsin, about 30 missile cruisers and frigates, several support ships, an unknown number of submarines. And by the way, there has been very little in the news about submarines, but I want you to remember that the Polaris, Poseidon, and the Trident submarines are able to carry many, many IRBM missiles, which, should nuclear exchanges break out, could literally obliterate the entire nation of Iraq and could just wipe Baghdad off the face of the earth. But unfortunately, that would include about 55,000 Filipinos and several thousand American, British, and a lot of other people. But that power is now there in the Red Sea and around Diego Garcia, out in the Indian Ocean, and of course the Eastern Mediterranean. And those submarines plowing along beneath the seas are able to launch those missiles without ever coming to the surface. So U.S. forces will include F-111 fighter bombers in Turkey, F-15 and F-16 fighters in Saudi Arabia, the super-secret stealth fighter bomber, A-25 tank-destroying jets, AWACS aircraft aloft as 24-hour radar watches and command centers, spy satellites, of course, watching everything going on in Baghdad, F-14 Tomcats aboard aircraft carriers, and men and supplies have been pouring in there unabated on an around-the-clock basis for about 2 weeks and more on the way. Venezuela said it would boost oil production by about 500,000 barrels per day, and West Germany sent minesweepers to Eastern Mediterranean to relieve American minesweepers on station. And even though the West German government proved hesitant to send troops, though now possessing the second largest army in Europe, they've been criticized a little bit from the United States and elsewhere since Germany has a larger stake in the Gulf than the United States. Now, with all these military, economic, and political maneuverings contriving to keep the entire world nervously waiting while Saddam Hussein engages in everything from saber-rattling of a ghastly variety like threatening the use of chemical weapons to acting like Idi Amin in parading a whole group of British citizens and patting the heads of little British boys and girls trying to act like Big Daddy to get these poor terrified people to kiss the hand that feeds them, which was a ghastly and a hideous thing to do. And by the way, some of the New York headlines were calling him a child abuser because of that heartless parading of some of his hostages. So look at the fact that here is the Bible, the Word of God, Jesus Christ, nearly 2,000 years ago, saying that you and I would be living in a time of wars and rumors of wars. And now look what is happening on a global basis, how it is affecting us economically, how the whole world is waiting on a moment-by-moment, hour-by-hour basis, glued to television channels, looking at weekly news magazines, picking up daily newspapers with their hearts in their throats because hundreds of thousands of families are now becoming involved because of loved ones being deployed in a very volatile, potentially deadly war zone. And here is a madman, Saddam Hussein, who has proved himself capable of incredible acts of bestiality in using chemical weapons against his own people, Kurdish citizens, and using chemical weapons in his protracted war against Iran. Now, he also proves himself an astute statesman in one sense of the word, and yet how ironic that for years of war with Iran, he finally ended up possessing about 700 square miles of territory wrested from them in all of those years, which saw the death of about 1 million people, some who died as a result of chemical weapons. And so quickly, in a matter of hours, he traded the fruits of that hideously costly struggle for freeing up his Iraqi divisions that were formerly stationed on captured Iranian soil, so he could redeploy them against U.S. and U.N. forces in Saudi Arabia or Israel. So now look at what Christ said about rumors of wars. Already, that brutal attack has sent reverberations around the world in oil prices, prices of gasoline at the pump, future prices of heating oil for the impending winter, trucking oil, and practically everything that we utilize or eat or put on our back sooner or later is going to get to us by truck. And I mean Canadian, American, British consumers, and in fact consumers in every industrialized country in the world from Brazil to Japan, feeling the pinch. And from the moment that the world learned of Saddam Hussein's pre-dawn attack, rumors of yet a greater war, that Saddam might immediately roll over Saudi Arabia or attack Israel, that it might break out into a nuclear exchange, that the United States might go to war against Iraq, washed around the world like a gigantic tidal wave, and those rumors of wars, as Christ prophesied, are what has caused the wild gyrations in global markets and sent these oil prices up and stocks tumbling and interest rates up and resulting apparently in slipping into deeper and deeper recession in the United States. All of this is a very real part of the prelude to the great tribulation prophesied by Christ in Matthew 24. Now, in the United States, where massive deficits threaten serious recession, this brutal aggression by Saddam Hussein might well result in a Great Depression. First, there's our approximate 50% dependency upon imported oil. Then there are the ongoing trade deficits with Germany, the EEC, and Japan. Most of our debt is in foreign hands. It is certain Arab states and the Germans and Japanese who show up at the discount window at the Fed, you know, to purchase U.S. government paper and finance the United States debt, about $200 billion a year. And if history is any guide, in a time like this where there is a crisis, sometimes within about 1 year, that debt quadruples. If it should do so this time, it would be nudging $1 trillion a year in red ink. Recently, one of the economists for the Wall Street Journal was asked whether or not these recessionary trends would mean that America would be unable to service our debt by interest payments. And he responded, not as long as the government can continue printing money. But he also responded that perhaps the time would come when these foreigners would have so little confidence in the American economy that they simply wouldn't show up at the Fed to buy government paper to help finance our debt. And as a matter of fact, Daniel Burstein, in his sensational book, Yen, that I've talked about several times, it's called Yen, Japan's New Financial Empire and Its Threat to America, said this, quote, "It is imperative to recognize that Japan has gained a measure of control over our economy unwise to cede to any foreign country, even the friendliest, best-intentioned ally." And recently, the editors of Business Week wrote, quote, "Wake up, America. We have spent too much, borrowed too much, and imported too much. We have lived beyond our means, relying on foreigners to finance our massive budget and trade deficits, and the bill is now coming due." Japan was caught totally unprepared for the Gulf oil crisis. Her timorous response, including docile compliance when Saddam ordered all foreign embassies in occupied Kuwait closed, and her reluctance and apparently virtual inability to send military help to the region will begin to grind on the Japanese people and the Japanese government, but it's going to require a constitutional change. Now, I've been saying for many years that things are going to gradually occur that are going to force Japan to once again put to sea a world-class nuclear-propelled and nuclear-armed navy. And this that is happening in the Gulf that threatens the life's blood of Japan that depends far more than we do upon Gulf oil might well result in doing exactly that. Burstein also said this in that famous book called Yen. He wrote, and I quote, "Japan could be the engine that pulls the third world out of its misery and teaches the superpowers that the arms race and economic development are incompatible. But although such ideas are sometimes voiced in Japan today, current events are not moving in that direction. The logic of contemporary Japanese policy, coupled with the leadership's need to defend itself from the illogic of American policy," he said, "creates fertile ground for crystallizing the almost inevitable consensus that Japan must convert the economic empire it has obtained into a political and a military one as well." I believe that what is happening today in the Gulf is going to cause both the Germans and the Japanese to take a good long look at their military capabilities. And perhaps there will even be constitutional changes. After all, there is a new government being put together very, very quickly now within the next couple of months in Germany. And I was there, as I said, just as massive increments of the East German parliament walked out, and they have now stepped up their date for reunification from December to about October. So Germany is going to be reunified in about another month and a half. And that will probably be the time when, in the light of what has happened in the Middle East, there could be a constitutional change that allows them to really build a gigantic military capability, including naval and air force units that they really presently don't have, even though they've got a very large standing army. So a long-term effect of this latest round of bloodshed and violence in the Middle East is sure to have a hardening of resolve among the leadership of both Japan and Germany concerning their own military capability and their life's blood, which is oil. And once again, the most immediate effect on the United States is debilitating rather than constructive. And for all the temporary wave of patriotism and nationalistic enthusiasm, any long-term stalemate in the region seriously injures the U.S. economy, allows time for solidarity among U.N. members involving sanctions to weaken. I give an example. There are tens of thousands, I think perhaps 50,000 some odd, Filipino workers in Iraq, and the Philippine government under Cory Aquino was very, very hesitant in a drawn-out argumentative process of, quote, considering, end quote, whether to permit the United States to use certain bases and attempting to differentiate between humanitarian shipments, like food and so on, to Iraq, and other supplies, because they don't want to see all of those Filipinos over there starved to death or used as pawns in some hostage time. And also, it gives time, as Saddam Hussein is already doing, to put faces on the American hostages. And growing cries of frustration and outrage will no doubt be heard from family members to negotiate their release. There will be a lot of pressure on the government to go ahead and just walk away from it, pull Americans back, let Hussein have Kuwait, and they won't really see the broad picture as they are blinded by their concern and their fear for loved ones that if this man is allowed to pursue his course and in 3 to 5 years from now have a nuclear arsenal, we will not be safe anywhere in this world and nuclear war could result. Now, let's take a look at Daniel, the 11th chapter. And in the few minutes that I have remaining here, let's take a look at this prophecy and see how it applies to what is happening now. First of all, in verse 40 of Daniel 11, reminding us that this is the longest continuous prophecy in the Bible, that it culminates at a time when the king of the north, the final individual identified as the king of the north, was Antiochus Epiphanes, one of the Seleucidae of Syria, and there was the king of the south, who was a lesser line of pharaohs, known as the Ptolemies, in Egypt. But notice the time setting. This is not the Seleucidae or the Ptolemies of ancient times, way back then, even prior to the time of Christ. This is a modern time because it says clearly, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, who? The king of the north. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom, and that is Turkey, and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon, and that means Jordan, and possibly even Iraq. And you'll see what that means immediately. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Now, the United States is not the king of the north. And Saddam Hussein and Iraq is not the king of the south. As a matter of fact, Saddam Hussein may be a part of Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon, and therefore will not even be involved in this great prophecy, which is going to be a trigger that results in the occupation of the Holy Land, the moving in of a multinational force under a United States of Europe, which will be the king of the north, because the beast has yet to emerge, a United States of Europe has yet to be put together, a temple has yet to be built, a king of the south has yet to emerge and put together some pan-Arab bloc. Today, we do not yet know who is the king of the south. Today, we do not yet know who is the individual who will be the king of the north. And so the facts are that this latest round of war, like the one in 1948, and the one in 1956, and the one in 1967, and the one in 1973, simply is not mentioned anywhere in the Bible. And that the long-term effects are going to be, as I've mentioned, a further debilitating effect on the U.S. economy, a further debilitating effect on global economies with the resultant problems it may cause in Eastern Europe and the overthrow of fledgling, shaky, tottering, little, beginning democratic institutions and governments. It's going to result in greater militarism and the building up of conventional forces and nuclear forces, as well as naval and air forces on the part of Japan and a united Europe under a united Germany. And it's going to result, perhaps, in a bloody nose, protracted involvement, and perhaps protracted withdrawal, and therefore gigantic economic crunch, and perhaps another sea of red ink for the United States of America. This prophecy in Daniel 11 shows that this king of the north is going to occupy Jerusalem and Palestine, and is obviously the very same time as when the great false prophet is going to stand in the holy place where it ought not, and where he's going to claim the very powers of God, and where perhaps the Pope at Rome is going to say it's time now to return to our most ancient origins, where the true church, as he's going to call it, started, and to go back to Jerusalem to protect the holy places and to call Jerusalem a corpus separatum, an open international city, and to occupy it. Now you see that it says he attacks Egypt. So that scenario is not in place today. Egypt today is cooperating with the United States and Saudi Arabia against Iraq. So the plain truth is that even though this is another further bleeding of U.S. economic means and is a major event that could break out into a regional war that could literally result in an attack against Israel and could result in the loss of tens or twenties or hundreds of thousands of lives, and that could happen, it is not yet the battle that is going to lead to the Battle of Armageddon, nor is it the fulfillment of Daniel 11, 40 to 45, the time of the end. It is that prophecy that Christ gave that we are living in a time of wars and rumors of wars. And so I say again, it is a time not to be frightened or faithless, but it is a time to watch and to do God's work.